Hello and welcome to this episode of the No Bullshit Anxiety Talk Show. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Kathleen Smith, author of the book Everything Isn't Terrible, Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. In her book, Kathleen offers a smart, practical antidote to our anxiety-ridden times. It's an informative and fun guide featuring a healthy dose of humor for people who want to become beacons of calmness in their anxious world. The New York Times bestselling author of Calm the Fuck Down, Sarah Knight, had this to say about the book. It's the perfect blend of hard science and warm wit that helps you understand where your anxiety comes from and then manage the fallout. And let me tell you, her book is brilliant. And the insight she offers up in this chat is first class. If you have any anxiety in your life, you're going to gain a whole lot from listening to this. When I recorded it, it was 10 o'clock at night and I was a little sick. And I was worried because I wasn't fully with it. But when I listened back to all of Kathleen's insights, I have to say I was blown away. It's really good, practical, actionable stuff. I'll leave it with you to make your own assumptions, but I do encourage you to really listen. And then maybe listen again. And finally, if you do enjoy it, don't forget to subscribe, share with your friends. And if you wouldn't mind taking a few minutes to leave a review, I would be extremely grateful. Thanks again and enjoy the chat. Congratulations on the book. I loved it. And I know you're a therapist, so this is obviously your work, but I'm interested to know where your inspiration came for the book, that Everything Isn't Terrible, because it focuses so much on anxiety. Is that what most of your work revolves around?
Well, you know, it does, first of all, because I work in D.C., right? So there are loads of anxious people in Washington, D.C.
Why is that?
You know, I wonder why. I have no idea why that could be. also, you know, the theory I was trained in thinks of anxiety as sort of all of our emotional reactivity. So it's not just a term for like a type of disorder, right? It's sort of all of that emotion that guides us sort of when we're fearful or panicked or stressed out, right? So we don't necessarily distinguish it as, you know, this is anxiety, this is depression, you know, blah, blah, blah. While those are important distinctions if you're not diagnosing someone or treating someone. But when I talk about anxiety, it is our response to any kind of threat, real or imagined, and how it manifests in relationships. So in the theory I was trained, at least, it's kind of a catch-all term for our reactiveness, our anxious autopilot that I talk about in the book. So I come at it a little bit differently, maybe, if you're thinking of it strictly as a diagnostic word, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's super interesting. I'm throughout the book, I love that, like, you pretty much, I know in the final chapter you talk a little bit about your own anxiety, and you know, I've had a lot of anxiety throughout my life, and reading every chapter is like, you kind of like just hit the nail on the head with like work anxiety. I know a lot of people that I speak to struggle with work anxiety a lot. Parents, relationships, every kind of different relationship is addressed throughout the book. So I think that's really cool. I know you're speaking about Bowen's theory, and I think that's super interesting, and I want to get into that. But just before we speak on that, one of the things that really stood out to me the most at the start of the book was when you said the challenge when a client comes to you is to get them focusing inwards, because usually when they come to you, that everything's focusing outwards, and that's contributing to their anxiety. So maybe you can speak to that a little.
Yeah, I mean, that's human nature, right? When we feel annoyed or threatened or bothered by other people, we focus on them because, you know, we've evolved and we've survived as a species because we've been on high alert and we're able to imagine potential threats, right? Like other animals can't do that, but humans can. And so while that, you know, sort of intense focus on other people and what they're going to do to us is useful in some ways, it could also get in the way of changing yourself and noticing how you contribute sort of to your own anxiety and how you get in your own way. And so, you know, that is really, it's a real challenge as a therapist to sort of shift that, help people shift that focus from, you know, why my boss is terrible, why my partner won't pitch in or listen to me, right, to who am I in these relationships and who do I want to be?
Yeah, absolutely. And a real challenge for everybody involved. Because, I mean, from the anxious mindset, it's so hard to kind of just change that perception, especially if we're talking like anxiety, depression, or whatever we're speaking about here is hitting like the 8, 9, 10s on a scale of 1 to awful, then it's all kind of self-consuming. Have you any tips on how you would try and get someone to shift that focus from the external to the internal?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the ways I help people think about that is to kind of zoom out. So it's not just looking at yourself, it's looking at the whole system working or the whole relationship, right? So I call it taking the astronaut view. And I talk about this in the book, you know, can you sort of hover above the room and mm-hmm. see how the other person is affecting you and how you're affecting them, right? And how you're sort of passing the anxiety back and forth and how it's contagious. And when people can kind of get curious about how it works versus who's to blame or whose fault it is,
because there's a lot of that.
Exactly. They can kind of go, oh, well, that's really interesting. You know, maybe if I tried something different, you know, I wouldn't get into this conflict, you know, with my boyfriend, or my boss's weird emails wouldn't bother me as much, you know? And I think it's really, you know, engaging that curiosity turns on a different part of your brain, right? Than the part that I call it the lizard brain that just wants to run away or fight people, right? It turns on that problem solving part of your brain if you can kind of be curious about it. And so my job is just to be curious and to be really fascinated by it, because I think that's contagious. If people think they see me being really interested by it, then they kind of catch that curiosity as well. At least that's how I think about it.
What I really love is the fact that you can just come out of your body, and I've never heard someone speak about it before, but actually go see how everybody is contributing to this anxiety. It's not just those people around you, it's not just your parents, it's not just your boss. It's actually, you have a relationship in this as well. And it's kind of like, you see it as gravity ball just moving around the sky. So I've never heard of anyone speak about anxiety in that manner. And I thought it was a really interesting way to go about it.
Yeah, and you know, and I would add to that, you know, it's helping people see not just how people are contributing to it, but how what people do is their best attempt to manage it. Whether you like it or not, sort of everybody is trying their best to calm themselves down, right? And when you can, if somebody's avoiding you, or somebody is trying to change your mind about something, or if somebody's trying to tell you what to do, right? That is their best way of calming down an anxious situation. Mm-hmm. And so I think when people can see that, then people all of a sudden, they don't seem like villains necessarily. They just seem like another anxious human who's trying their best. And I think that helps people get a little bit less focused on the other person and why they're wrong.
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. I know a few people that are going to benefit so much from just hearing that already. So you're a big advocate of Bowen's theory.
Yeah, so Murray Bowen was sort of the father of family therapy, and he was a really interesting guy. You know, back in the day, everyone was trained in Freud, right? Everyone was trained in psychoanalysis, but he worked with people who had schizophrenia, and he noticed by observing their families that, you know, when they came to visit them at this clinic, that people sort of did better or worse based on how their families were relating to them, right? Their families didn't cause the mental illness, but their outcomes had a lot to do with how the family functioned. And so he kind of came up with the idea that, you know, if you're looking at, you know, mental health, like the smallest unit is not the individual, it's the family, right? Or the organization or the workplace or the community. Mm-hmm. And that if you can see how everyone is trying to manage the anxiety, you really just need one person. It doesn't have to be the sort of identified patient, right? You just need kind of one person who's willing to be curious and observe and maybe try to act outside of that like automatic way of calming things down. And that sort of calmness and maturity was almost kind of contagious. And that you could really reorient how a family functioned by one person doing that thinking and doing that work. And so he, you know, that was just sort of a revolutionary idea because everyone previously had sort of been looking at the individual, and to a large part they still do today. But he was sort of a systems thinker, and he saw that, you know, you could observe this in nature too, right? With other animals, it wasn't just a human thing. So he was a really, really interesting guy.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In your line of work, so if you're speaking to a client and they've got a lot of things going on in their family, you know, I know there's a quote there that there isn't a family going that isn't dysfunctional, but right. If you have a client that's particularly traumatized with what might be going on with their parents and how they're being treated by their parents, and are you trying to train them into trying to kind of train their parents into being more curious, or are you training them specifically into being more curious and to try and take the lead role within those family dynamics?
Yeah, so I'm helping them try to be one person in their family who can think for the and act for themselves. and not just in relation to what other people are doing, right? So, you know, if they're going home for the holidays, you know, and, you know, their mother always asks them or complains about, you know, I don't know, their other sibling, right? And they get into a fight with their mother, or they go to the other sibling and try and do what their mother wants, right? They, you know, increasing their ability to think about how they want to respond to their mother's anxiety. You know, what do you actually want to do in the situation, you know? And because what often happens is that so many of our actions are a reaction to our family. We either, you know, kind of give in and do what they want, or we rebel and do the opposite, right? Because they're annoying the hell out of us, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and so, but neither of those reactions is a choice, right? It's just it's an automatic reaction to what's happening. So the more a person can choose and separate their own thinking and their own feelings from their families, you know, the less allergic they are to everyone else's anxiety. So when they are around, you know, it doesn't mean that your family doesn't bug you or bother you some, but you're less sensitive to it. And what I always tell people is that if, you know, you can do it in your family, you can really do it anywhere. It's sort of the hardest place. The analogy I give in the book is it's like when Olympic athletes, you know, when they train at higher elevations. Mm-hmm. To be better able to compete, I think of working on yourself in your family as similar to that, because those are the relationships we're the most sensitive to and the ones where we're usually the most reactive. It's the hardest to be mature in your family.
Oh, Christ, yeah. 100%. And a lot of people that kind of rebel within their family and come up against an awful lot of trauma and inner conflict within that rebellion in itself, because they're just not getting what they want out of it, and they're not feeling listened to or cared for, or that the family understands, or, you know, the multiple reasons, and it just kind of spirals everything out of control. It's such an interesting approach. So talk to me a little bit about the differentiation between thinking and feeling.
Right. So When I first thought about this, and I wrote about this in my newsletter this week, I assumed that feeling was bad and thinking was good, right? But that's not the case. You know, we need our automatic emotional reactions because they actually do work pretty well a lot of the time, right? That's how we've survived as a species, right? If I am fearful of something, I need to act quickly, right? That emotion is a guide for me. But sometimes I don't necessarily need to act quickly, and something is not as fearful as I actually think it is, right? And so being able to separate your thinking from how you feel in the moment is very important, because your thinking, in my mind at least, is guided by your principles, what you actually believe, who you're actually trying to be, the willingness to sort of put up with your anxiety to do what you think you need to do, to not necessarily relieve the anxiety, what I call, what Bowen actually called the anxiety of the moment. So much of what we do every day is just trying to calm ourselves down as quickly as possible, right?
So, 100%.
I have a voicemail I don't want to listen to. I'm going to avoid that voicemail and put it off, right? Because that calms me down in the moment. Or, you know, my husband is loading the dishwasher wrong. Maybe I'm going to tell him do it this way, right? But that, because that calms down the anxiety I feel that something could go wrong, right? That's a very small example. But maybe I need to listen to that voicemail. Maybe I need to step back and let my husband be a competent adult, which he completely is, right? You know, but that means I have to be willing to put up with that emotional discomfort to be the person I'm trying to be, right?
Yeah, so you have to feel it. And that kind of brings me on to the next point that you mentioned in the book, is be willing to sit with temporary anxiety to achieve long-term calmness.
Right. And I think people have a really hard time kind of wrapping their minds around that, because we tend to measure how well we're doing based on how anxious we feel. And that's not always a good measure, because if you're pushing into unknown territory, if you're kind of turning off the autopilot, right, it's going to feel very uncomfortable, at least for a while. But the idea is that over time, your sensitivity to certain situations will go down because you're able to be more objective. You're able to kind of stay in touch with the reality of the situation more.
And when you say we measure ourselves on how anxious we feel, by that, I would assume that, in my mind anyway, by that, like, if I don't feel anxious, I think I'm doing pretty good.
Yes, but you have to look at what you're doing, right? And, you know, if I am, you know, if I have cut someone out of my life and that calms me down, right? No, I'm not saying that cutoff can't be a useful
and helpful thing.
But sometimes you lose that resource of a person, right? What is the long-term cost of always cutting people out when they make you feel anxious, right? What is the long-term cost of overfunctioning for your kids, right? They don't learn to be competent adults, right? So you have to weigh the cost of the behavior with how effective it is at calming you down temporarily, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I guess one of the angles I'd come at, and from what I've kind of seen in my life, is when people start to do this work, when they're willing to, and usually it takes a while, unfortunately, you know, we'd often wait till it's unbearable before we do something about it. And, you know, there's always a peak, from my experience, when you go in and you face this, you know, often for the first time, and you start looking inwards, it can be a really terrifying experience that gives rise to a hell of a lot more anxiety. And unfortunately, many people seem to, and I understand why, but that will be enough, that rise of anxiety will be enough to put people off and kind of tell them that this is not the way to achieve less anxiety in life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the example I'm thinking of is you know, I work with a fair amount of people who are afraid of flying, right?
Okay.
And so, you know, not ever flying again is a great way to manage that anxiety, right?
Yeah.
But what, again, what is the cost? What do you miss out on when you choose to manage it that way? And, you know, the on the flip side, the cost is probably having quite a few very anxious flights in order to maybe have a calmer experience in the future, right? So people have to weigh the pros and cons of and define what they think is progress, you know, and you know, going into it thinking that you're going to have a calm experience doing something different is fooling yourself.
Absolutely. I've never, I'd say one of the few areas in my life that I've never experienced any anxiety, touch wood, is on a flight. It's just, mm-hmm. it's not something that bothers me in the slightest. And one friend that's coming to mind now, I think, you know, she hasn't gone home in 3 years, and that's how terrified of flying she is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the weeks, the months building up to a specific flight are, they become an ordeal within themselves.
Right, right.
How do you work with someone to calm them down with such extreme phobia towards flying?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are any number of ways. My biggest thing is I'm really curious about people's own thinking. I'm a big advocate of, you know, instead of telling people what to do, having them come up with their own ideas and testing them out, because I think people are better students of themselves than, you know, a stranger who's just meeting them for the first time. But, you know, one thing I ask people is, how do you access reality in these situations? Like, what facts do you need to know that are useful for you? You know, is it, you know, knowing the facts of how a plane works and the actual statistics? Is it knowing the fact that visiting your family is important to you and that's a part of, you know, what you want your life to be? People have different motivations and different pieces of reality that help them kind of manage the anxiety in the moment. And I think also knowing that it won't kill you, right? Like, it sounds very cliche, but, you know, teaching people that, you know, anxiety is manageable, not to sort of downplay how it feels or the effect that it can have, but knowing that it will not kill you, and asking yourself, am I willing to put up with this temporary anxiety to, you know, pursue the life that I want, can be helpful for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you come up against much resistance when doing that? Well, what's to say it won't kill me? You know, what's to say the left phalange in the plane isn't in deep trouble?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's focusing on the reality, right? You know, yeah, sure, you could die on a plane, but what are the actual odds of that? And statistics. Do you want to live your life based on those odds, you know? For some people, that's helpful. For others, it's not. You know, other people, I think recognizing that they're going to have some failures, they're going to have some times where they don't get on the plane or where they cancel a trip, right? And how they deal with that setback is a big part of it too, right? Not just assuming that everything is going to be 100% success every time. What mindset you bring to it, I think, is really important as well.
Mm. Yeah, mindset is everything. So what kind of tips would you give people to improve their mindset around in general?
Yeah, I mean, I think knowing, you know, in the book I talk a lot about guiding principles, right? And I
yes.
think of my principles are sort of the opposite of what my anxiety would have me do most of the time. You know, it's a blueprint for what the person I'm trying to be. And if I have those written down and available to me, when I feel anxious, I have at least some chance of turning off that autopilot. You know, if you haven't done that thinking, if you don't have those ideas written down, it's really hard to do anything different, you know? And so like a classic example for me is I love to overfunction for people. I'm a helper, right? That's my actual profession. So I love to tell people what to do or take a control of a room if things are chaotic, right? Like, that's how I manage my anxiety. But that gets in the way of me letting other people be capable adults, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of my principles is to step back and let people be responsible for themselves. And kind of putting that in sentence form and having it written down and something I can reference helps me know what to do when I walk into a meeting that's incredibly disorganized, right? Or when my friends can't decide where to have dinner. You know, I don't always swoop in and just decide for them, right? Because that's one of my principles that helps me change sort of that anxious mindset into something different. And so that's one thing I help people do. And I'll, you know, most of the stories in the book are about helping people sort of develop those principles for themselves so they can access that thinking when they're anxious, because it's so difficult to do.
Yeah, I guess it makes an awful lot of sense to have them thought out and written down and kind of like embodied within your subconscious.
Yeah, and I encourage people to, you know, they may change over time, but it's important to have a couple ideas written down. So, you know, if you're going to visit your family or you're going to have a really tricky meeting at work, right? Can you write down a couple sentences that describe what being a mature human looks like in that situation? And that's something you maybe can remember in the moment then, so you don't just function entirely based on fear or, you know, that emotion.
And so what would it, like, because I know towards the end of the book, there's an exercise there and you write guiding principles for your family life, your work life, different areas of your life. What would an example of, say someone is, a lot of people get very anxious in meetings. So what would an example of maybe some guiding principles that can help get over the hump of dealing with intense anxiety that doesn't allow you to speak up in a meeting situation?
Yeah, one principle could be, I will share my thinking and not try and manage the reaction, right? So what we often do is try and control how other people respond to us, right? Especially when we're nervous or feeling inadequate. So if you can remind yourself, my only job is to share my thinking when I think it's important. My job is not to sound impressive. My job is not to convince anyone of anything. My job is not, you know, is not to, you know, whatever. But holding on to that piece, this is my only responsibility, is to share my thinking. And can I look for an opportunity to do that? Suddenly that seems a little bit more manageable and a little less scary than trying to be the smartest person in the room, right? Mm-hmm. Because where we get ourselves into trouble is when we try and control the thinking and behaviors of others, because we really can't. But that's where our focus is. That's what we're trying to do a lot of the time. So if you can put the focus back on yourself and expressing yourself, being a mature human in the room, that's a little bit easier job than trying to control everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. And what other examples, say, of guiding principles now within a family dynamic would you be able to give?
Well, you know, it's the same thing. So first you have to know what it is you do when you're anxious. So if in your family, say, if your way of managing the anxiety is to try and tell your parents what to do, right? Or how to be healthier, or how to date, or how to deal with your siblings, right? Or how to manage their money, right? Your guiding principle might be to step back and let your parents be responsible for themselves, right? Or if your way of managing anxiety in your family is to never share anything about yourself that a person might disagree with or take issue with, then your principle might be, you know, I'll share what I care about and let people respond how they want. And so it's again, it's just putting the focus on what it is you're trying to do and taking the focus off of controlling everyone else's reactions to it. And that, now that doesn't, you know, I'm not trying to downplay that can't be difficult to actually follow through with, but at least it gives you a starting point for doing something other than what your anxiety would have you do.
Yes. And, you know, if you're chronically anxious and you hold resentment towards, say, let's just say a sibling. Let's say there's two siblings, and both of them have, you know, their shit going on, and both of them are dealing with a lot of anxiety. And how do you guide them, or guide, it's only one person you're speaking to here, but a lot of their anxiety in their mind is a direct result of how their sibling treats them. So as a result of that, there's a lot of resentment that's built up over the years, and that's there, that's existing, and that's causing them real trauma that they're carrying with them, that's compounding over time. What would you say is the best approach to dealing with that?
Well, at least from a Bowen theory perspective, what you do is you zoom out. So you draw a diagram of the family system. You go back a generation or two, mm-hmm. and you see how, you know, how the family functions has set them up to have conflict. And not that it's anyone's fault, but to see how their positions in their family, you know, have created the situation where they're going to be fighting with each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it has to do with sibling position. It has to do with parents' relationships to siblings. It has to do, you know, if you go back a generation or two.
Yeah, you really recommend this, go doing the research and going back a few generations and studying up on this.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to, it's a little bit different than genealogy. It's sort of like the emotional history too, right? In addition to the facts. So see how, you know, did your parents have this conflict with one of their siblings in a similar way? Are you in a triangle with a parent who's also sort of perpetuating the conflict? If you can zoom out and see how multiple people are sort of functioning in a certain way, all of a sudden your sibling isn't necessarily the villain. It's sort of a system doing what it does. And you have to ask yourself, okay, what do I want to do here with this reality? And I think it helps people calm down a little bit to see that it's a sort of multi-generational, multiple people thing. It's not just a two-person conflict.
Okay, cool. That's super interesting. I know it's very different to genealogy, and there's websites and all that kind of set up to genealogy, but there's probably not websites set up for family dynamics and dysfunctional families and seeing what went on the generations before you. How would you propose actually kind of doing that research in the first place? Would it be a matter of going to your parents and having an open conversation, or going to your grandparents if they're still alive and just fishing around and like...
Yeah, I mean, you can learn a lot just from the facts. You know, what was going on in the family when this person was born? You know, and maybe if things were anxious, then that kid got more of the anxiety, right? And they were more sensitive just based on what was happening. Or, mm-hmm. you know, asking your parents or your grandparents, you know, who did you talk to? Who got cut out of the family? You know. What happened to them? You know, did they die early? Just knowing all of the stressful events that kind of are the soup of our families, right? And if you sit there and you kind of look at it all written down, you know, at least when I did this with my dad's family, I went, oh my goodness, no wonder everybody's anxious. You know, all of these things happened and people were doing their best to manage them, but it was a lot, you know? And I think asking your parents about the facts first, as opposed to just their interpretation of them, is really useful. Mm-hmm. And just asking questions like, well, what was it like when you were a kid? Or how did you get along with this person? Can really reveal a lot. And I think it gives you a clue as to sort of what patterns are kind of passed down through the generations for dealing with stress. You know, in some families, there's a lot of cutoff. People just break off contact and that's how they deal with it. In other families, there's a lot of conflict, right? And so you'll see different things in different families.
Yeah, 100%. My mind's a little bit blown right now. That sounds so fascinating. and so logical. And I have heard about someone, you know, obviously relating to their parents' anxiety or passed on from generations, but I've never heard of actually going back and doing the research yourself that I guess essentially would leave you with a higher level of empathy that's all for all that might be going on in your family. So in this situation now, so the research is done and there is a higher level of empathy and understanding, but there is that still kind of like resentment there and still some lingering feelings of anxiety that have, you know, been around for years. Now, is there anything in Bowen's theory that says how you go and approach that next step after doing the research?
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily even call it empathy. I mean, I feel like Bowen people aren't even that into empathy. It sounds terrible, right? But for me, it's like objectivity, right? You know, being able to see how these emotional forces have kind of shaped people in the family, you know, and to ask yourself, what could I benefit from working on myself in this relationship? You know, I think people often go into it thinking, oh, we're going to have this big reconciliation and they'll see the error of their ways, right? Or they'll become a better person. And that's not necessarily the case. But the benefit of being able to be your best self in a tricky relationship is huge, right? And I think it's easier to see the other person as a resource the calmer you are. First of all, you can enjoy the relationship even if they're a jerk sometimes, you know, sometimes. But it, like I said, it also, the work on those family relationships benefits other relationships in your life. And if people have kids, I think it's a big motivator too, you know, to have a one-to-one relationship with everybody in your family is such a resource for your kid, because first of all, it models that for them, right? But also they have relationships with all of those people too. Those people are resources to them. So, you know, a lot of times I encourage clients, if they can't really get the motivation themselves, thinking about their kids in the next generation can be a motivator for them.
Okay. That's brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. In your experience, what would you say is the biggest cause of anxiety or the biggest complaint that you come across?
Well, I mean, I don't think of anxiety in terms of like cause and effect. I think that, you know, at least in Bowen theory, there's this idea that every family has what's called chronic anxiety. They have some amount of chronic anxiety that they have inherited from the previous generation. Now, that doesn't mean like day-to-day events can't be stressful in particular. You know, like big things like deaths or births or, you know, weddings or illnesses, right? Those will shake up a family for sure. But we all have some sort of amount of anxiety that's just in us that we largely have gotten from our families, you know, from genetics and from the environment, right?
Yeah, and I guess my question particularly is around the environment. So say in somewhere like Washington, D.C., where there's a lot of anxiety at the moment, is it coming from work? Is it coming from the news, politics? Is it coming from families, like relationships?
All of
the above, but is there anything that you see more of or a specific generation?
Well, I think, you know, I work with a lot of millennials. I'm a millennial myself, you know, and I think one thing that I see a lot is that sort of, I feel like the boundaries of themselves are kind of, I want to say it more permeable maybe, you know, we are so focused on the approval and attention of others that it is very difficult to be guided by yourself. You know, I think social media, etc., certainly contributes to that, right?
100%.
And in the news too, right? We don't decide what's scary or what we should be concerned about. We are told, right, that everything and lots of things are scary and we should be reactive about them. So, you know, really helping people think about what they just assume or take as reality from what they see around them or the people in their lives, right? Versus doing their own thinking and their own responding to different challenges in the world, I think is something that's useful for a person to spend some time thinking about, because we kind of just take things as fact, right? We take society's definition of success, right? And we just assume that must be true, right? As opposed to doing our own thinking about what we want our lives to look like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or we take society's definition of what a good relationship looks like, right? Instead of doing our own thinking. And so, you know, that's not a new thing. That's been the challenge of humans for forever. But I think technology makes it especially difficult.
Enhance that something serious, right?
Yeah.
Especially with millennials essentially being the first generation to experience such a crazy shift in the world that we're living in.
Sure. I mean, we just don't have the time and space to do our own thinking. And I think it's important for people to kind of carve that out in their day-to-day lives.
And would you say that's the, if you were to like speak to an audience of millennials, like, would that be one of the biggest points that you'd be driving home, is that to like stop focusing on other people's lives and start focusing on your own?
Yeah, I mean, to do the work of, and this is a Bowen theory term, defining yourself, you know, defining yourself in your family, defining yourself at work in the larger world. To figure out what that is, or else you're just going to be trying to accommodate and please everyone else all the time.
Okay, and define yourself by setting your guiding principles.
And activating them when you are anxious.
Ah,
that's the tricky part.
That's where the practice comes in.
Yep.
Very good. You're a big Seinfeld fan, I would imagine.
I am, yes.
Because I really enjoyed your newsletter this week. And you used the Seinfeld analogy for George, where he just said he was ticked off with the cheese sandwich or something. He was just going to start doing the opposite of everything he usually does. And I guess that's known as the anxiety of progression. And I think that's a really interesting theory. And I know we've kind of touched on it a little bit throughout the conversation, but maybe we can just kind of dive into it a little bit before we wrap this up.
Yeah, so I guess the simplest definition is the anxiety of progression is sort of the anxiety you feel when you're activating those principles, right? So when you're willing to put up with the anxiety of the moment to be the person you're trying to be. And I think when people can see that as progress, they think about anxiety a little bit differently. They don't, because often I think we shame ourselves or we feel guilty, right? When we are doing what we want to be doing, but we still feel really worked up about it in the moment. And I think you have to cut yourself a little bit of slack, because anytime you're doing something different, it will feel, you know, that alarm will go off in your brain that says, don't do this. This is risky. Bad stuff could happen, right? Mm-hmm. And so seeing that anxiety, at least you feel in the moment, and being willing to put up with it, is a very difficult thing, but I think if you can see it as progress and note it as progress, it does help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's so powerful. I think that's just such an incredibly powerful analogy that is easy to follow. I mean, everything that you speak and write about in the book is easy to follow, but this one in particular just grabs me, and you're here going, no, this is the price I'm willing to pay, and the more I pay it, the more I benefit and the less anxious I feel. Whereas on the other hand, if you don't pay the price, you're actually going to be a hell of a lot more anxious as a result.
That's the thing. Yeah, the temporary relief has a cost, right?
Mm-hmm. 100%. So you have a newsletter, The Anxious Overachiever.
Yes, I write a newsletter every week. I talk about sort of how I'm working on myself or what I'm thinking about or what I'm working on with clients. It's a lot of fun to write. I enjoy it.
Cool. Where can people sign up for that, Kat?
Yeah, they can just go to my website, KathleenSmith.net, and it, you know, you can't miss it. It'll pop up and
oh, you're right. Get in the face. Get in here now. Subscribe.
Yeah. So, and I promise, I only send it once a week. I never bother people more than that.
Okay. Well, I've been signed up for 2 weeks now, and I've received the two of them, and they've both been great. So I highly recommend people to check it out. I'll put all the links in the show notes. Where can people find you and get your book?
Well, you can buy my book anywhere you buy books. It's pretty much available everywhere.
Is it in Europe? And
so the thing is, it's available in the UK and Commonwealth countries as well, but I don't know exactly how book buying works in Europe. I would think that people would be able to get it on Amazon and other places in Europe. There are a couple translations that are going to be coming out, but none of them are currently out yet. So it's just the UK version that people would be able to buy.
Okay, well, I'll link to all the Amazons, and obviously you're in the bookstore. The book is called Everything Isn't, I nearly said is, Everything Isn't Terrible, Conquer Your Insecurities, Interrupt Your Anxiety, and Finally Calm Down. It's a great book. If you are dealing with any kind of anxiety or trouble in your life, you're going to get a whole load out of it. Before I let you go, what would be your three tips for someone dealing with anxiety and looking to calm down?
Well, the first thing I would advise is to be curious, to start to observe how you function and to not beat yourself up about it, to just sort of be a researcher, be an anthropologist, and to kind of watch what you do. And then the second thing would be to evaluate. So ask yourself, is this who I want to be? Is there a different way of functioning that might reflect, you know, my values, my beliefs, my principles a little bit better than this anxious version? And then the third thing, and I talk about all this in the book, is to interrupt. So to look for opportunities to not do what you would normally do, right? To feel that anxiety of progression, to be okay if you fail and just revert back to your anxious autopilot, right? But to look for those opportunities to do something different and to see what happens and see if that's the better way.
Fantastic. They're awesome tips. Dr. Kathleen Smith, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks. It was great.